Hello, welcome to The Moment That Made Me, this time.
The Air Force in the end took me on as a test case, but they did write in the letter to me that I was being taken on as a test case to see how far someone with no aptitude could get before I failed.
One of the first women to become an RAF fighter pilot.
I had a chop ride the following morning. There's a knock on my door. It's a course mate. And he said, Mandy, we're taking you out this evening. And I thought, absolutely not. And for the next few hours, we would simply cycle up and down this parade square with one of them yelling, 30 starboard, 60 port. My instructor just said to me, wow, that was like flying with a different pilot. What on earth has happened?
The moment that made Mandy Hixon came the night before a make or break flying exam on the 20th of August, 1998.
I was a young pilot. I was going through fast jet training. I was flying the Hawk T Mark 1, so not very much technology on board that aeroplane. So none of what you see today when we've got the sort of head-up displays and moving maps. We basically had a stopwatch, paper map and a compass. And yeah, a young pilot basically going through her fast jet training, and I was starting to struggle a lot and starting to lose my confidence. And yeah, that's when the moment that made me came about.
So you were starting to struggle, you were losing your confidence. Can you just tell us a little bit more about what exactly was going on with you?
Yeah, so to give you a little bit of history on that as well, when I joined the Air Force, I'd failed all the aptitude tests to be a pilot, not just once but twice. And because I was flying with the University Air Squadron at the time, I had some evidence to say that I was actually an okay pilot, and it didn't really correspond to the fact that I was failing these tests. And so the Air Force in the end took me on as a test case, but they did write in the letter to me that I was being taken on as a test case to see how far someone with no aptitude could get before I failed, which was a really interesting concept, you know, to frame it like that. So in the back of my mind, I'd always had this feeling that I was going to fail at some point because they'd planted a seed of doubt. And so as I was going through the fast jet training, you know, things were getting harder and harder. And we were doing something called tactical low level, where a formation of two aeroplanes head off at very low level, so 250 feet, the height of a pylon, traveling of speeds normally around 420 knots, but sometimes accelerating up to, you know, just below 500 for target runs. And you're sticking with your wingman at all times as a pair of aeroplanes, primarily because the instructors are also basically the enemy up there, and they're trying to simulate coming behind you into your 6 o'clock position to simulate shooting you down with an air-to-air missile. And you have one blind spot when you're flying, it's directly behind your jet. So if you're an individual, you're almost guaranteed to fail. But if you've got a wingman there, you've got someone who can provide that mutual support that can check your six as well. In fact, not just behind you, but in fact, all around you. But it means you must coordinate your turns. You can't just be coming up for a turn to the left and just think, I'm off, because then your wingman is behind you, you're both vulnerable and you're exposed. And so this takes a lot of planning. And so if you're turning to the right, for example, both aeroplanes will pull up. You will then go towards each other and cross at a perpendicular angle of exactly 90 degrees before you then roll out into the onto the new heading. And then you're in perfect formation. And that's when I was failing. I was so caught up in the numbers and the minutiae that I was just not seeing the bigger picture.
And just tell me a little bit more about that moment on the 20th of August, 1998, because presumably you were failing and things were coming to a head, and you maybe had this thought going on in your head, it's becoming self-fulfilling. They said that they set me up to fail and I'm about to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Sitting in my room, I had a chop ride the following morning. There's a knock on my door. It's a course mate. And he said, Mandy, we're taking you out this evening. And I thought, absolutely not. Why on earth would I go out celebrating the fact that they'd all finished drinking, you know, beers or whatever, when I've got the chop ride the next day? And he said, no, you need to trust me. And he took me to the bike sheds, and obviously the trust waned at that point. But we got onto our bikes and we cycled to the other side of the airfield, and there waiting on all of their bikes were the remaining members of my course. And for the next few hours, we would simply cycle up and down this parade square with one of them yelling, 30 starboard, 60 port. And we did all the manoeuvres in the air that I couldn't grasp, you know, on the ground. Sorry, we did them all on the ground, that basically what I couldn't grasp in the air. You know, without the vertical separation, of course, because we are on bikes and it's not Harry Potter. And everything fell into place for me. And it was this moment in time whereby ultimately I recognised the power of the team and the support that I had from my teammates, my course mates, my wingmen was phenomenal, because it's that feeling of selflessness, of coming together. And they went the extra mile when there was absolutely nothing whatsoever to gain themselves, because you built up that level of trust and that level of camaraderie. And also they gave me this amazing different cognitive diversity. You know, we always talk about diversity in teams, but they gave me a different perspective. I've been practicing it in the same way, doing the same thing, getting the same results. And suddenly they said, let's think about this outside the box. Let's think of it in a very different way. And suddenly that framing of it just gave a completely different perspective of my learning. And that was the moment that made me.
And if you can just take me back to the moment you went down to those bike sheds, you got the bike out and you're getting on the bike. What was going through your head? Did you think this is ridiculous?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. What on earth are we doing? Are we cycling to a pub? You know, that's what I actually thought. And he said, please just trust me. We've had a great idea. And it was just that, you know, what on earth is happening? And then to see all the rest of my course mates all waiting, and it was a summer, it was August of 1998, and it was, you know, twilighty in the air, and of course you get those summer nights in Anglesey. Oh, it's like a movie, isn't it? It was a bit like a movie, because you could imagine we're all cycling around in this beautiful sort of sunsetting, you know, environment.
So how long did you cycle around the parade ground for?
It was definitely a couple of hours until things felt more natural for me. And I think because I'd been so, I'm very, I wouldn't say binary, but I love a plan, and I like to have all the numbers written down, and I've worked out the degrees, and that's what I was focusing on, was the wrong thing. And they recognised that these turns that we were doing is more of a visual perspective. And if you were to practice it on your bikes, you would pick up the actual feeling of the turns, and just looking at the bigger picture to see how do you cross over and then where do you roll out. And suddenly it meant that your head is now out of the cockpit. You're not in the cockpit at low level, which is incredibly dangerous to be. You know, they say it should be sort of 95% out of the cockpit and just scanning what's going on inside. And I think that they just had the idea to do that. And when I flew the trip the next day and it went really well, my instructor just said to me, wow, that was like flying with a different pilot. What on earth has happened? And I told him what the guys had done, and he just said, wow, that's unbelievable, you know, because to some degree, although you're not in direct competition, there's always a limited number of spaces, you know, and if they were guaranteed spaces on the next course and suddenly there's one more person coming through, it means that potentially they're not on that course and they could wait up to, you know, another 6 months, maybe 9 months for their course to start. And so there is that feeling of selflessness that was evident that night. Yeah, and it was this moment in time, really.
And so they were jeopardising their own places for you. Why do you think they did it?
I think what's interesting as well, you know, we talk about camaraderie within the forces, and it's something that actually really interestingly I hadn't grasped just how important that was to me as well. So after leaving the Air Force, I'm asked all the time when I'm speaking, do you miss the flying? And I say, I miss the flying, but I miss the camaraderie more. Because this sense of belonging and a sense of team is something that the military actually work quite hard to build up, you know, that sense of selfless action to build trust within teams. They send you on adventure training. It's not just because it's fun. It's because you're going to be put outside your comfort zone. You're going to build up trust with your friends and your colleagues that you potentially wouldn't do if you were just sitting in a pub.
And I guess that night you learned a lot more than just about battle turns. You learned about yourself. You learned about teamwork. I mean, quite a light bulb moment, was it?
It was. But also what was really interesting as well, Kate, was that about a month before this, I'd written a letter to the station commander because I was the only girl on my course. And by now I'm sort of 4 years into the Air Force and I'm a bit war weary. I just wanted my own space. And I said, sir, I've got a really good case for this. I would really love to rent a house or rent a flat in Rosniger so I can get a bit of my own space because it's really quite intense. And the letter just came back. It said, no, your teammates are everything. And I reflect now how wise that station commander was, because he knew just how important it was to be going through this shared experience of the intensity of that flying training course, living in the same space as your colleagues and your friends and your teammates.
And that night where they really stuck up for you and helped you out, not the first time, as you mentioned, when you failed those aptitude tests, someone stood up for you then. And you say that is perhaps because you were kind of being used as a test case to see if you fail the aptitude test, how far you can go. When you look back at that moment, how do you feel about that?
Well, I often reflect that without that man, without Squadron Leader Carl Bufton at the time, I would never have had the career I'd had, because he put his neck above the, you know, that parapet, you know, and he basically exposed himself to say, I'm going to challenge system and processes, because they realised that the majority of women taking the tests were failing them at that stage, and they'd never been tested on women. And so that he sort of uncovered this unconscious bias that was existing within the testing system that they then went on to change. And so it's a really reflective moment for myself to look back at people that have made monumental differences in my life. And when I'm asked to speak at women in events, I say that's all very well and good, but at every single stage of my career, I have been lifted by a man. You know, it's always, always those people. And so it's never about the them and us. It's about the team together.
And what a career you've had. Service in Iraq, 3 tours of duty, more than 40 missions flown. How do you reflect on that?
I think I'm very lucky. I feel honoured to have had the opportunity to do that at a time where there was a real changing of the guard, where women were being allowed for the very first time to fly on the front line of operations. Had the wonderful Jo Salter, who had led the way for us. And then there was a bit of a pause before the next group, who were all being recruited from the outset. We weren't in the Air Force. And so there was almost like a 3-year period where we were then brought in as new officers to then go through flying training. And I just think I'm blessed to have been in the right time at the right place and being given the opportunities that I've been given. And I think when I look back now, I think that that is what is important to me now, is that legacy of change, that we've made it so much easier for others to follow in our footsteps.
And tell me a little bit about your experience, the time when you narrowly missed a surface-to-air missile.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a nervous moment, should we say. I was flying about to recover back to base. We were just quite near the Kuwait border when we're in an area which had been very benign up to that area time. Nothing had ever happened in the 3 months preceding it. And suddenly my navigator just yelled, "Mandy, break right." And basically, when you're normally engaged by a surface-to-air missile in a theatre of war, you will pick up a lot of information on your warning, your radar homing and warning receiver, your RHWR, which is a piece of equipment in the Tornado, which gives us a spike to tell us that there's a radar on the ground looking at us. If a missile is sent in a heat-seeking mode, which is really unusual, you won't get any advance warning. And as he was looking, he just had his night vision goggles on, and he turned to the right and he just saw this flash, and then the igniters of the missile locking in. And that's when he yelled to me to break right. We did the manoeuvre we've practised so many times before, but never obviously for real. And we put the flares out at the exact moment I chilled my engines. And we watched a missile go from being locked onto us to pulling off on our flares and exploded a few miles away. And I'll be honest, it was probably the closest I've ever come to losing my life. But also it makes you realise just how important the training that we'd had. Because he said what he said, And we practiced and practiced and practiced it. It meant that actually we could do an action that was immediate, a measured response, as opposed to just reacting to something, you know, haphazardly.
And that was over Iraq. And it's interesting that you say that is the closest you came to losing your life. And yet you didn't choose that as the moment that made you. You chose the cycling on the parade ground.
Yeah, there's been many moments where things have happened, where you have emergencies. And I do believe, although they stick as moments in your life, it wasn't the moment that made me. I learned a lot about myself. I learned about decision making under pressure. I learned about fear of failure, of letting my team down. You know, I'd learned about leadership, not my own, my boss's that night. But the moment that made me is the moment that actually enabled me to have the career I've had. And I think often the moment that makes us is the moment where we have support from other people. And it's not just about our actions, but it's about coming together as a whole.
And when you talked about evading that surface-to-air missile, had you been able to use what you learned on that parade ground to help you in that situation? Was there a link?
Yeah. So, I mean, interestingly, yeah, when you're flying over in Iraq, we were always in battle. I mean, we weren't at low level. For us, it was a medium-level war. But we always fly in battle formation. So even if you're doing the turns, you're still turning in your battle formation, which was the basis. And that's why it was so important to get it right at Valley, that fast jet training, because every single thing that you're going to do from that moment onwards will, at low level flying or medium level, if you're flying as a pair of aircraft, which you nearly always are, for that mutual support, you will always be turning down to tactical battle turns. So yeah, it's the basis of everything.
And that experience back in August 1998, what kind of person did it make you?
it made me a very humble person. It made me recognize that I could not do it by myself. It made me believe that actually you're part of a whole, and that it made me very thankful for the people that I was going through my training with, that they were not bystanders. They didn't look and watch somebody struggle. And there were many times throughout my flying training when those same course mates would stand up to instructors, pull out sexism, pull out banter where it had gone too far on my behalf without me asking them to do it. They did it because they wanted to do it. And I think that's that feeling of, you know, when we talk about, you know, mixed gender teams, do they work? I think without a doubt it changed them as well. And I think it certainly changed me, but it made me recognise that, you know, the military is an incredible organisation to be part of. And that's what it does foster, is that team spirit.
And what you learnt there from your course mates, have you been able to use it yourself? Have you been able to pass it on in your career or since?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I left the Air Force, I trained to be an airline pilot. And then I was flying a young cadet, a young girl called Emily, as part of the air experience flying. And actually passing on that love of flying to her, she at the end of it just said, oh, my goodness, this is all I've ever wanted to do. And in that moment, she said it to me, you know, I want to be a pilot just like you. I realized that I didn't want to just become an airline pilot. It had never been my passion. And she opened up an entire new chapter of my life, which led to me doing keynote speaking at conferences, in schools, to all different organisations, and passing on that love of flying, but also representing really what change is all about, facilitating the future, you know, and actually that legacy is really, really important to me. And I say that the ladder is no longer down, it's welded, and others can follow so much more easily in our footsteps.
You and I spoke a few years ago when your memoirs were published, and you talked then about overcoming imposter syndrome. Did that moment cycling on the airfield, did it make that happen for you? Did it make you overcome imposter syndrome?
I don't think it helped. It certainly helped because it made me recognise that I could achieve what I wanted to. But I still do have a little bit of imposter syndrome. Ironically, it's whenever I get asked to speak to a military audience, actually, because I always think, why on earth are they asking me? Even though I've spoken at events all over the world for the last, you know, 12 years, and I've built a really strong name as a speaker, I still think, what on earth can I talk to them about? I'm just Mandy from Manchester. So I still do have imposter syndrome a little bit. But I think there's a difference between feeling anxious and imposter syndrome. And imposter syndrome is when it stops you from doing something. So now I always say yes. And then I might regret it and sweat it a bit beforehand. But at least I've said yes. So the imposter syndrome won't stop me from doing it. That's the important thing.
And what lessons are there for all of us, Mandy?
I think the lessons are that we can't do it alone. And even if you're running your own business, it's about building up networks. If you're going through school, it's about having your wingmen around you. And I use wingmen literally as wing person, should I say. But having those great friends, colleagues, talking openly, you know, there's so many issues around mental health, but these are the people that will make the difference to you as well. And so I think the lessons for myself is that, you know, we are part of a team, and that is human nature, is that we work better with others. So don't ever isolate yourselves. And I think that's really important.
And you're still friends with those course mates?
Absolutely. In fact, we have the Royal International Air Tattoo. I'm a trustee for the RAF Charitable Trust, so I will be there for all 3 days. And I'm really excited about that, because what's really lovely is they'll all be there. So many of them have stayed in. They're quite senior officers now. So they'll all be there in their uniform. I will be there as a trustee, but I'll also be doing some fantastic interviews with the likes of Tim Peake and the Red Arrows, Miss World and Miss England as well on the stage. And it's a great opportunity to celebrate everything that we have achieved so much.
What about bike riding, Mandy? Do you still do it? Do you do it with those course mates? I mean, would you like to do it?
I'd love to do it with the course mates. Yeah, no, I have an electric bike now. My husband and I do it, but as he's a pilot as well. Every now and then we'll be going across the field and he'll suddenly yell, shackle, or 94, 94, go. And suddenly I have to go back and I'm transported straight back to that parade square and he will do the manoeuvres. He loves it. He always does it because he did the same sort of things, but he was in the Navy. But I mean, you can't have everything. Yeah, so we always have quite a laugh when we do it. And people look at us as we're cycling across our local fields going,
I bet they do.
What are they doing? Yeah.
Mandy Hickson, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Kate.